This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic. He's an English anthropologist based in Finland, and he has a show on YouTube and BitChute, the Jolly Heretic. He's also an author of numerous books on themes of evolutionary psychology. So, Ed Dutton, it's great finally getting to speak with you.
Hello, how do you do? How do you do? Thank you for having me on.
Excellent. So, as far as themes go, how would you describe the themes you're interested in? It's a pretty wide variety of topics, politics, culture, humor. Would you say there's a general focus on evolutionary psychology and anthropology?
No, well, not so much anthropology anymore, no. The general focus is on religion. I'm interested in understanding religion, and I'm interested in understanding the evolution of culture, basically, and that brings me into all kinds of areas like intelligence and personality, the evolution of those, and so and then how they cross over with religion. That's really been my research area for the last 8 years or so.
Can you kind of explain like what personality types are, but the different personality types, like how that is playing out in current politics, and the people who are more dedicated to a cause versus there are people who may be more agreeable who go along with it, and also kind of explain your concept of the spiteful mutant?
Well, it's my colleague Michael Woodley of Venice term spiteful mutants. The idea is that we were under harsh Darwinian selection pressure, harsh purifying selection, until really the Industrial Revolution in about 1800. And until that time, it was about 90% of people didn't breed. In Western societies, and indeed, it's been found from modelling that you have, in order to maintain health in any group, 90% of people must not breed. So there was 50% child mortality, and then about 40% of people either witnessed all their children die before them and didn't pass on their genes, or they just didn't get married. And so only 10% of people passed on their genes. And those were the healthiest 10%. Those people were optimally adapted to the environment, both psychologically and physically. And so with the Industrial Revolution, of course, you have the rise of much better hygiene, much better medicine, inoculations, things like this. And so child mortality collapses, and you get the rise of all of these mutations, this growing mutational load in the population. We become increasingly genetically sick, as all of these people who would have died of childhood diseases and measles and whatever grow up and increasingly pass on their genes. And so you have this increasingly physically sick society. But the thing is that the gene, the mind is 84% of the genome. It's a massive target for mutation. And so this means that if you have problems with the body, if you have a weak immune system or whatever other manifestation of physical mutational load, so that you're physically unhealthy and wouldn't have survived under these conditions, you're bound to have problems with the mind. And indeed, it's been proven, and modelling has demonstrated this in detail, that as a consequence of the collapse of harsh Darwinian selection with the Industrial Revolution and so on, reducing child mortality from 50% down to 1% today, there's been a massive rise in basically mental mutations, and consequently in mental illness, in depression, in autism, in schizophrenia, and in all manner of other more subtle problems. And so This has fundamentally altered the nature of the population, and what it means is that you have people who would never have survived under normal Darwinian conditions for physical reasons, and they're going to have minds that also would have been selected out under those conditions, and therefore minds which are maladaptive. Now, what was selected for under those conditions was, one example is we run a very, very harsh selection, and we run a very, very harsh group selection. So there were battles between groups for survival and for passing on your genes. And what if group selection militated in favour of highly cooperative groups that were highly positively ethnocentric and highly negatively ethnocentric, because computer models have shown that those are the groups that survive under conditions of group selection, the ones that are high in positive and negative ethnocentrism. And secondly, you have religiousness. That was clearly selected for. We know that was being selected for under Darwinian conditions. Why? Well, religiousness is associated with mental health. It's genetically associated with mental health. It's associated with physical health. It's associated with fertility. There are specific parts of the brain that are associated with it. And if you stimulate these parts of the brain with magnets, then people become both more religious and more ethnocentric. So, and a number of other things, which means it's adapted for. And so what you get then is a deviation with the collapse of Darwinian selection. You get a deviation away from this system. You get increasing deviance from this pre-industrial, for want of a better term, norm, and you get these people that have all kinds of weird ideas that would be maladaptive, and those ideas then spread like contagion throughout the society, and people start to adopt more maladaptive ways, because we're a highly eusocial species and we're highly sensitive to our environment. And so we increasingly find ourselves in this evolutionary mismatch where we're surrounded by people that have maladaptive ideas, and they spread those ideas. It's been demonstrated, for example, that depression is contagious. And mental illness, unsurprisingly, because it's a manifestation of high mutational load, is associated with all of these maladaptive ideas, like that you're a left wing, basically, that you're an anti-natalist, that you're pro-multiculturalist, that all of these ideas, this whole suite of maladaptive ideas that will, if a group adopts them, will destroy them, are associated with being mentally ill, are associated with high mutational load. And there's lots and lots of markers which indicate that's the case. So that spiteful mutants, therefore, are extreme examples of this process. They reach positions of power in the society, and they are able to therefore influence even non-mutants, even non-carriers, with their maladaptive ideas to behave in maladaptive ways and damage the genetic fitness of themselves and of their society. So that's what spiteful mutants are.
Society is more hyper-individualistic in the West, like a decline in ethnocentrism, especially like positive ethnocentrism. So I think when a lot of people think about ethnocentrism, maybe the buzzword racism goes off, but there are a lot of benefits would be higher social capital, higher self-esteem, and greater economic opportunities of being part of that in-group. How much of that is, would you say, is based on the culture? How much is ethnocentrism a heritable trait?
It's very strongly heritable. We're dealing with very strongly heritable things. The heritability of racial prejudice is 0.7. I was looking at this recently. It's 0.7. So this is a highly heritable trait. I mean, what you're going to expect to be happening is, as we move into this kind of clown world where it's ever more woke, then you've got all if you're environmentally sensitive, if you're sensitive to the environment, things are heritable. So something like intelligence is heritable. It's 0.8 heritable on average, okay? But you're going to get some people that have an IQ of, let's say, 130, purely for genetic reasons. So they have an IQ of 130, and that's their phenotypic minimum. If they had a really good environment or whatever, a much better environment, then they'd have an IQ of, 145. But they have an IQ of 130. You're going to get other people that have an IQ of 130, and that's their phenotypic maximum, i.e. it's because of their environment that they've got that high IQ. There's variation in these kinds of things. Now, similarly, in how people respond to a spiteful mutant run or influenced culture that is telling them to do maladaptive things, telling you that you shouldn't pass on your genes, telling you should feel guilty for having children because it damages the planet, telling you you should promote the interests of other ethnic groups, which are basically just extended kinship groups, over your own, and all these kinds of maladaptive things that they're telling you to do, If you are highly environmentally sensitive, or even slightly environmentally, if you are anything for environmental reasons, you will do those things, and therefore you will be less likely to pass on your genes. And so all you're left with in terms of the people that are actually breeding are the people that are highly adaptive for genetic reasons, i.e. the people who the whole environment is telling them don't have children and don't think there's meaning to life, and they still do. They still do. So you would think that these traits are going to be highly heritable. At least for those people, and so consequently they continue to behave in an adaptive way even when the environment is doing everything it can to make them behave in a maladaptive way.
So yeah, there does seem to be there are these kind of antinatalist factors within society, and the groups that resist that are the most resilient. So I mean, especially among like European descended peoples, I think you kind of see a reversal where the people who will win out in the long run. So right now we're seeing very low fertility, but then in the long run you'll see the people who emerge out of that, they'll be religious, but also more in-group preference.
Right, because fertility is itself heritable. So clearly we're going to be selecting for fertility. So that means that in the future there will be higher fertility. Presumably fertility is becoming increasingly heritable. Because in the past, you'd have all these people who the environment would be telling them to be fertile. The environment would be this highly religious environment that was promoting fertility as the will of God and all this kind of thing. And these people believed in God, and therefore they had lots of children because it was God's will. Now that environmental impact has gone. All that's going to be left is people that are highly fertile for purely for genetic reasons. And so consequently, you would expect the heritability of fertility to go up, and you would expect the future not just to belong to those that have lots of children, but to specifically, therefore, to those that have high genetic traits which make them highly fertile.
So yeah, it's primarily like religious groups have higher fertility, like Mormons, Muslims, Orthodox Jews, and then also there's also like the U-shaped trend in fertility where rates are highest among the wealthy and the very poor, but lowest among the middle class. And you were saying in one of your talks that historically it was highest among people who were wealthier, so this is a more recent phenomenon. They would, in a sense, sort of like repopulate the middle class, and that was better for more social cohesion. So you have income inequality combined with declining fertility among upper classes. That is worse for social cohesion. There is also this kind of trend of a U-shaped trend in fertility.
I don't know where you've got this U-shaped fertility from. If you look at the data from Western countries, if you look at those that are on where both parents are working, those where one parent is working and one's on welfare, and those where both parents are on welfare, then only those where both parents are on welfare have above replacement fertility. At the moment, fertility is associated with low IQ and by extension with being poor. There's a degree to which that is more limited among men, because men who are very poor are more limited in their ability to have children, because women sexually select for status and don't find men that are very poor attractive. Overall, if you add both sectors together, then it is people that are poor that are having more children. It is people that have low IQ, which is associated with being poor, that have more children. People who are uneducated that are having more children. Though there are some national variations in that, but overall across the West, that's what's going on.
Personality traits definitely are going to have an impact, but looking at also like fertility and economic success, like what personality traits lead to economic success. So there is the kind of like dark triad personality type, and the view that like elites are all like psychopaths, and those types do exist. I think like as a whole, I see it's more like agreeable, low on neuroticism, extroverted, and like those kind of traits.
The way that it seems to operate is that you distinguish between those that are extremely high achievers and those which what we might call normal range high achievers. So if you look at the normal range of socioeconomic success, then intelligence predicts socioeconomic success at about 0.3, 0.4. So your 0.5 rather, about 0.5. Your earnings are associated with IQ at about 0.4. Your education level, lifetime education level, is associated with IQ at about 0.5. how well you do at school, in school exams, things like that, is associated with IQ at about 0.7. So one of the factors is clearly intelligence. Another factor is personality. So how educated you are is associated with conscientiousness, which is impulse control and rule following at about 0.55. There is a weak association between doing well at university and agreeableness, presumably because people that are agreeable are more likely to sort of listen and imbibe information and not be too sort of arrogant and things like that. There is a very weak association in terms of doing well at university with an optimum level of neuroticism. Neuroticism is mental instability, so feeling negative feelings strongly, anxiety, things like that. And the argument is that that's because an optimum level of neuroticism works as a kind of motivator. You know, you worry about whether you're going to do well in exams, you worry about the future and whatever, and so you work harder. Not too much neuroticism. Too much neuroticism is crippling, means you become depressed and whatever, and you can't think straight. Add too little neuroticism and you don't worry. So there's an optimum level. I'm not aware of any association particularly with extroversion. And openness predicts doing well in certain kinds of subjects, in arty things and that sort of thing, because that's kind of basically what openness is. So that's how the personality works. Then you have to distinguish between those people and the outlier achievers, the really amazing. And that's very interesting. If you think about, for example, if you look at it in academic terms, although you could extend this to other fields, if you look at what geniuses are like, and they're a bit different. They have outlier high IQ, so massively high IQ. Generally, IQ means that you can solve cognitive problems, particularly problems that are similar to problems that you've come across in the past. Outlier high IQ means you can solve extremely difficult problems indeed. And outlier high IQ is also associated with autism traits. So that's interesting, because that means that autism traits are the opposite of aspects of agreeableness. If you've got autism traits, you're low in empathy. You don't empathize. You don't kind of understand other people's feelings and things like that, which people that are agreeable do. You have aspects of mental instability as a consequence of being autistic, because you're hypersensitive to sound and stimuli and things. Why is that? Well, because intelligence is about solving problems, and so if you're massively intelligent, then you're going to be able to take in more information, thus you solve problems better. So therefore, you can't filter out information, so you take in more information, you solve problems better, but it means that you're oversensitive to stimuli. Anyway, that's the intelligence of these geniuses, so it's a different kind of intelligence, and they combine that with moderately low agreeableness and moderately low conscientiousness. Moderately low conscientiousness means that they are not bound by the rules. They can think outside the box. They think in a highly creative, intuitive almost sort of way, and therefore they come up with original ideas, and original ideas and original ways of doing things always offend, and so consequent, and if you're low in agreeableness, you either don't care that you offend people, or you're too autistic to realize that you're going to offend people, and so therefore you come up with original ideas and you become really, really successful. Similarly, what you were talking about, businessmen and dark triad traits, exactly, at that kind of level it's cut and thrust in politics or whatever, and you've got to be able to go in for the kill, and that will militate in favor of a person that is extremely high IQ, plus these dark triad traits such as Machiavellianism, which means that you are obsessed with power, which will incentivize you to want to get power, such as narcissism, because you won't, you know, you'll think you deserve the power and whatever, and such as psychopathology, which means that sometimes, you know, you'll cheat and whatever and get to the top. So there's this distinction between what you might call the midwit, you know, the normal range successful people, which is associated with intelligence plus general factor of personality, basically, i.e. pro-social sort of personality, and the people that are very, very successful. That can be associated with a very, very high IQ plus moderately antisocial personality, or in the case of artists, very, very high IQ plus moderately antisocial personality and mental instability.
This is all covered in the OCEAN personality test of personality traits, and I took the online test, and I'll briefly go over my results. So I got very high in openness, mid-level of conscientiousness, very low in extroversion, moderately low in agreeableness, very high in neuroticism. What would you say is notable about those results that I got?
What were you in neuroticism?
Very high.
So you're very mentally unstable.
And then moderately low in agreeableness, low in extroversion, a mid-level of conscientiousness, then very high in openness.
Well, I don't know how can I say. All I would say is that one of the problems with these instruments is that you compare yourself to people that you are around and that you know. So they only work within culture. They don't work between culture. So if I was talking to you and we were both English, then it would mean something. But it's because you're American, and as far as I can see, levels of extroversion are higher in America. I mean, I can't see how. It's hard to test that empirically, because it's hard to test these instruments between cultures. But I think it's fairly obvious that Americans are higher in extroversion. Extroversion, by the way, is associated with taking risks, and therefore it's associated with immigration and moving about. You'd expect, therefore, Americans to be higher in extroversion, and Australians and other people, immigrant peoples, to be higher than the people from whom they come, because they've taken the risks and they've got their ancestors rather than taken the risks. They've gone abroad. So you seem quite extroverted to me, but then I'm speaking to you as an English person, and we're almost certainly lower in average extroversion than you. So and also the other problem with it is that they're self-rated, and often that is not as accurate as peer rating. So people often, the person you know least in many ways is yourself. And so consequently, it's often better to get people to... I mean, when I self-rate these tests, I always come across as being neither extrovert nor introvert. But everyone that knows me insists that I'm extrovert. I think part of it as well is a matter of how you see yourself. So one of the things is you think about how these things work across the lifespan. The personality is not stable across the lifespan. Personality, I mean, there's a correlation of something like 0.6. between what your personality is like as a child and what your personality is like as an adult. Now, that means that, of course, there's a core, if you like, that is you, because there is that, the correlation is there. It's not a correlation of nil, but it's only a sort of middling correlation. And perhaps I was more shy when I was younger. I was more introvert when I was younger than I am now. I was almost 40. And so, consequently, I still see myself as like that. And so the tests can be misleading in that way. So you could be fit. You could have a perception of yourself from when you were younger, which is not necessarily what you are now.
You did talk on the personality type of the genius. So, very high IQ, but also tend to be like lower on agreeableness because they're willing to risk cutting off social ties or offending people. And some of these people have become famous artists and scientists. But my impression is there are a lot of these types who are high IQ and low on agreeableness, but they're kind of overrepresented among this demographic of like the smart but poor. Is this type, like, was there something unique about, I talked about this, I did a show with Anatoly Karlin, who you had on about the Grey Tribe, like about the coffee salons of Western Europe. I mean, you did have these other, like East Asia is also very high IQ. There wasn't so much the same concept of a sort of like the genius, the eccentric, the intellectual. They sort of need a very specific environment to thrive. What are your general thoughts on these traits, and what type of environment do they need to thrive, and what trends do you see happening with these traits based on current trends?
So based on current trends, the geniuses, it could be argued, are a product of group selection. So if you have two groups that are in competition, as a rule, it's not a good thing to have antisocial people, which is what geniuses are, they're antisocial people, among your group. So when you talk about why this issue doesn't exist in Japan or China so much, I would suggest it's because in that kind of environment, it's a very, very harsh, historically, very, very harsh, very harsh, very stable ecology, and that, under very, very strong levels of selection and group selection. And this militates against the rise of genius for two reasons. First of all, because it's so harsh, you end up with a small gene pool and very little deviation from that gene pool. But how do geniuses happen? Well, they happen by genetic chance. Normally they're born to kind of normal range intelligent parents, but by just unlikely genetic chance, they happen to have outlier high IQ. Well, unlikely genetic chances are less likely to happen if the gene pool is smaller, which it seems to be in Northeast Asia. So That's one reason why you don't get geniuses in Northeast Asia, because the gene pool is so small. Secondly, the flips are, and the unlikely genetic chance, that the genius intelligence has to manifest alongside low agreeableness and low conscientiousness, when normally intelligence goes together with high agreeableness and high conscientiousness, at least to a limited degree. So it's a very unlikely thing to happen. The second problem is that the flip side of the genius is the criminal, basically, is a person that has criminal traits, the low IQ criminal, and the low IQ person with low agreeableness and low conscientiousness, the criminal. Now, that's so, if you're in an environment like the Japanese and the Chinese, you're so up against it in terms of surviving that you can't possibly permit those people to manifest. The good side of those, i.e. the occasional genius that might do something brilliant, is more than outweighed by these people, because you're so up against it that they could bring you down and they could destroy you. And so for that reason as well, you don't end up at the genetic level with geniuses in these kinds of ecologies. So you end up with an ecology which is highly, highly based around, highly, highly cooperative, extremely cooperative. And then that's a further problem, because it means that even if you did, by some unlikely chance, get a genius, then there's such a geniuses are going to be in some senses quite individualistic people, and so they're going to be totally kind of crushed down by the conformism, by the pressure to not offend, by the pressure to get on with everybody and whatever. So you basically have a kind of anti-genius culture in these kinds of countries. I think you're increasingly getting that at universities these days. It's all about not offending people and getting on, and basically, you know, head girl type ideas. So that's why you don't get many geniuses in Northeast Asia. You can't have much of a genius strategy in low IQ countries, because and also there's not much pressure to produce geniuses, because there's not much group selection anyway, where they come in is where you have a reasonably large gene pool, but you have a strong level of group selection. And when you have that strong level of group selection, one way that you can beat the other group is by being highly ethnocentric and whatever, but another way that you can beat the other group is by having a larger gene pool which throws up geniuses, which means that amazing inventions can be generated, which means that you can beat the other group in warfare, and because you're not so negatively ethnocentric, you can trade and you can develop ideas from other people, and you can grow, and there could be a sort of Goldilocks zone in which that strategy, the genius strategy I call it, as opposed to the ethnocentric strategy, works. And that would be a strategy that was not too sort of slow life history strategy like Japan and China, and not too fast, but somewhere in between. And that's what we seem to have. And so we've developed this system. You have strong levels of group selection, and this selects high levels of genius, and then you have high per capita levels of genius. Now, what's happened over the when you talk about the trends of genius, is it's clearly going down, because until the Industrial Revolution, we were under these harsh group selection conditions, and so there were high levels of genius, and they were increasing high levels of genius as we were selecting for intelligence and selecting for intelligent groups and selecting for groups that have lots of geniuses. And so consequently, the per capita level of innovation goes up. It reaches a peak in about 1870, so around about the time of the Industrial Revolution, and it's now gone down. We're now a third of peak. So our IQ, based on that, our level of per capita genius is back at the level that we were at in 1600 now, which is consistent with the idea that we are becoming less intelligent, which we clearly are. Based on current trends, we'll be back to the same level we were at in about 1100 in terms of per capita genius by the end of this century. So based on current trends of intelligence decline, that's where I'd see things going. Just less and less and less per capita genius. Fewer and fewer and fewer geniuses.
Yeah, as far as this whole like a demographic of like the smart but poor, would you primarily explain that as people who are very low on agreeableness?
The smart but poor, I don't know. I'm not familiar with too much. It's quite a rare thing.
Yeah, there hasn't really been adequate research.
To the extent that it exists, it's quite possible that if you had a high IQ, but you were so low in the personality traits that are associated with socioeconomic success, that it outweighed your IQ and to such an extent that it rendered you poor. That's quite possible. That's perfectly possible. If you were very, very high in intelligence, not that you were a genius, but you were very high in intelligence and you were very low in conscientiousness and very low in agreeableness, then you, to such an extent, then you may well get someone who is high IQ but poor, yeah.
Could you make the case that a dissident or red pill politics are maladaptive as a reproductive strategy? They tend to attract people who are lower on agreeableness and more likely to take risks, but if it could impact like their employment prospects and their social status?
Well, a reproductive strategy is relevant in terms of what it does in terms of the ability to have children yourself, in terms of the ability to pass on your genes indirectly at the kin level, and in terms of your ability to pass on your genes indirectly at the group level. In terms of the fact that you are in some small way helping to elevate your group genetic interests, one could argue that being involved in such things is group selected and thus is inherently an adaptive strategy. If you're talking about adaptive at the individual level, I don't know if that would, it's hard to tell. As far as we are aware, the fertility of those that are basically, the more conservative you are, the more fertile you are. The more conservative are your political views, the more far right are your political views, the more conservative you are. And so that implies that certainly there is a relationship. I didn't say it's causal, but there is, I think, that the two are the manifestation of one underlying factor, which is just basically being having low mutational load and being the kind of people that would have been around in pre-industrial times. But those people tend to have the most children. It's just an empirical fact.
There has been like this this discussion of the incel phenomenon, and there's a lot of different social factors, and then also looking over the traits. So there is the incelosphere. They talk about like the looks, money, status theory, but obviously there are a lot of people from the who are poor, both men and women, who have a higher fertility rate. So what do you see as the key factors why we're seeing this rise in incels? Have you noticed any specific traits that are more common besides the obvious ones, which would be low economic status or less physically attractive?
So when you have a situation where under ancient conditions we have polygamous societies. Why do we have polygamous societies? Because men are sexually select for youth and beauty, because they have nothing to lose from the sexual encounter. Youth and beauty and sexual beauty are selected for genetic health, because beauty is a manifestation of low mutational load. Females have something to lose, and so they sexually select for status, because if you have a high status man, then he'll be able to invest in the offspring, and then the woman and her offspring will be more likely to survive. Consequently, they all want to have a high status male. That's what the women want. They are selected to want high status males. Now, what this leads to, if you have a society like this, is all of the women orbiting around the high status male, the alpha male taking all the women he wants and leaving a few for the beta male, and then none for the gamma male. And so among the hunter-gatherer sort of peoples, about 60% of the males don't ever have any children. They don't breed. What this leads to is high levels of intermale conflict, intermale violence, an unstable society which doesn't internally cooperate and is bad at group selection and gets dominated by the societies that are more cooperative. How can you reduce intermale violence? Well, you can introduce monogamy. If you have a system of monogamy, you're still going to get women having affairs with high status men and whatever, but if you institute a culture which says that you have to have monogamy and that any deviation from monogamy is terribly bad, then you're reducing this intermale violence, because all, or at least quite a lot, a majority of the men are going to have access to females. And so therefore you're going to get a more group selected society, which is going to dominate other societies in the battle of group selection. And the religion is going to promote that as the will of God. And then you're going to have a whole culture that's based around monogamy. Now what we've seen in recent decades is the complete breakdown of that religion. And the complete breakdown, therefore, of the cultural norms which were holding monogamy together. And so therefore a complete sexual, or not complete, but very, very substantial sexual liberation, where everybody can have sex before marriage and people can have sex with whoever they like, and there are still certain cultural limitations to it, but basically the culture is loosened to a very significant degree. And so then what you end up with is, and also the connection between having sex and having babies has been reduced by contraception, reliable contraception and whatever. And so then you get these fast life history strategy women and fast life history strategy men. They are evolved to live fast and die young. We're all on a spectrum from fast life history strategy, where you're evolved to invest in sex and have sex with as many people as possible. And
so could you make the case that incels are hyper K-selected in some cases?
No, exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. So there are selected people. K-selected, you invest in nurture. So in an ecology like this, where you have reliable contraception, people that don't want to invest in nurture, they don't want children, they're R-selected, they just want sex. So you get these kinds of women, they're R-selected, they want lots of sex, and they want sex to a great extent with high status men, and they have sex with high status men, and these men will have sex with lots of women, and then you're going to get these men that no woman wants to have sex with, and so she doesn't. And so you end up with a situation where you get lots and lots of men that no women want to have sex with, and a small number of men that lots of women want to have sex with, and they do. And the reason they get away with that is because the culture, which meant that was totally socially unacceptable, has fallen apart. So that's where I think incels come from. That's why we have a rise in the incel, because of that breakdown in the cultural norms with regard to the regulation of female sexuality, with the breakdown of patriarchy and the breakdown of monogamy. And so I think a lot of these incels, as far as I can see, there are strategists. They're not gay strategists. There are strategists. They seem to want to have a good looking woman, and they can't get who is a fast life history strategist. But then they can't get one. They might be able to get slow life history strategy women. Maybe, I don't know who are, but those kinds of, but that's who wouldn't go around having affairs and whatever. But that's a different issue. As far as I can see, these kinds of men are fast life history strategists. Ask yourself this: do these incels want to have sex, or do they want to have families? What's their primary goal?
No, but I think you hear probably a combination of both. Like, I don't think it's dramatically. I think that is the norm for younger men in general. Just based on societal trends and like a decline in family formation and marriage. So yeah, I mean, you talk about like a fertility decline based on IQ, and as far as physical appearance goes and beauty, I mean, there is a class component, how attractive women marry up in class, and then you see declining fertility in middle to upper classes, but is there any metric to measure whether there are fertility differences depending on like physical appearance? Because there's not a concrete metric like IQ.
Well, we're getting uglier, that's for sure. I mean, there was a study on that which compared ancient skulls, you know, from hundreds of years ago or whatever, to modern day representative samples of skulls. We're getting uglier, but that's because we've got obviously a rising mutational load. I don't think there's any question about it that we're getting uglier. But I don't know if you can talk about there being selection on this basis. Probably indirectly there is, because there's selection based on there's selection based on personality. Women, for example, that have higher in extroversion on average or in certain traits seem to have larger breasts. If you were fast life history strategist, you'd have larger secondary sexual characteristics. But then there's all kinds of factors that are working in different directions. So no, I'm not aware that there's any good data on selection changing for certain physical traits, no.
Obviously it's insane when there are like woke types who say beauty is relativist and it's all based on culture. That's insane, but there's some nuanced disagreement, but it does seem like specific countries which are known for beauty, like there seems to be like a correlation with lower fertility, and they also tend to be more hyper case selected.
Well, yeah, if they're case selected and the environment is held constant, so if they have the same kind of environment as us, and they are more case selected than us, then you would expect people that are case selected tend to be highly environmentally sensitive. And so therefore, even if they had the same kind of industrial environment as us, that would actually be more of an evolutionary mismatch for them. They'd be more sensitive to the changes. And so you'd expect that to heavily damage their fertility. And I think that's why fertility in places like Japan is so low, because they're more K-selected than us, and the environment is about the same, and they are more sensitive to the environment, so it damages them more. So they're more messed up than we are, because even though the environment's pretty similar, because they're more sensitive to being in a maladaptive evolutionary mismatch of an environment, and so it makes them behave in maladaptive ways to a greater extent than it would us. I think that's where that's why even though they haven't had immigration really, even though they haven't had all of the evolutionary mismatches we've had, they're doing worse. And you have these herbivore males, and they have sex like half the amount that the next nation does, and all this kind of stuff.
Is there a correlation between like sexual fetishes and high on neuroticism?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. Yes, because part of that could be an underlying factor. So if you are high in sort of mutational load or high in developmental instability, then everything will go wrong, i.e. you'll go wrong such that you'll be set up for a fast environment in which you'll be mentally unstable and your sexuality will develop in a peculiar way. So that could be one thing. Another thing is that the mediating factor is autism. So if you're autistic, then you're interested in things, you're interested in objects, and therefore sexuality goes awry and becomes more focused around sort of objects and things, and you become neurotic because you're autistic, and being autistic is associated with aspects of neuroticism because you can't make sense of the world and you get overstimulated easily and you become anxious and so on. Or the autism is associated with neuroticism because it's just a general factor of being high mutational load or developmental instability or whatever. But there is certainly a relationship, yes, between fetishism and anxiety and those kinds of traits, yeah.
Is there any validity to the Freudian theory that repressed sexuality is channeled into creative endeavors?
Yes, there was an interesting study, Kim et al, I think it was, and they looked at this and they got religious people and they primed them with notions of shame about sexuality, and then they found that they became more kind of creative as a consequence. So that there does seem to be some truth in that. That Honor de Balzac said that whenever he had sex, oh, bang goes another novel. And there does seem to be some truth in that. And as societies develop more, they suppress sexuality more, and as they suppress sexuality more, then that energy has to go somewhere, and it goes into work or creativity or whatever. Yeah, there does seem to be an element of truth in that. Interesting study by J.D. Unwin, his name was, who died in about 1940, and he looked at this, and he looked at the relationship between how developed tribes were and how sexually repressed they were. And what you find is that tribes sort of social organizations become more developed, more intelligent, whatever, and when they reach their peak, when they reach the peak of their brilliance, then they are highly sexually repressed. And then as they go backwards, as they become less intelligent, like we're doing, and they become decadent, they become less sexually repressed because they're getting less intelligent, they're getting less religious, they're getting their environment is very, very, very luxurious, so they are low in stress, they become less religious, the religiousness tells them to be sexually repressed, they become less sexually repressed, become less creative, and it just becomes this kind of snowball effect of collapse.
As far as, like, what is considered like deviant or not, like what is, from a reproductive standpoint, and like what is maladaptive as a reproductive strategy? So a lot of right-wing types are homophobic, but one thing you said, like, about a homosexuality is, like, there is, like, the gay uncle who invests in their nephews and
the gay priest that invests a shaman that invests in the group level.
Yeah, they invest, I think, like, there are evolutionary benefits to homosexuality. Also, I think, like, the idea, there's also a theory that, like, James O'Meara at Countercurrents puts out about homosexuals as, like, the creative class.
Yes, I think there is certainly evidence that there is some truth in that, and it would help to make sense of why homosexuality is found in basically all cultures, or at least feminine men are found in all cultures, and why these men seem to be attracted towards religious roles and things like this, at least in primitive tribal organizations, and towards sort of creative sort of roles. So yeah, I think that's where I think that's a reasonable theory as to where why homosexuality is 0.4 genetic in males. And so I think that may well be where it's come from. So you're going to get the group-selected homosexuals, but also homosexuality is associated with high mutational load and developmental instability and things. And so increasingly you're going to get homosexuals that serve no purpose level at all as selection pressures weaken.
And you did a talk on characteristics of, like, large age gaps. So, I mean, there's obviously reproductive advantages about in regards to fertility, but I noticed, like, one of the latest, like, kind of woke trends has been shaming, like, public figures who are in a relationship where there's a large disparity, and it's also been impacting, like, homosexuals now. Like, they were going after Glenn Greenwald and this congressional candidate, but you do see, but especially among, like, heterosexual men, like, it is being promoted as, like, a new taboo. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, all I would say is that if you go out with a person that's, if you're a man and you go out with someone that's much, much, much younger than you, then you're clearly a, that is the ultimate sort of our strategy sort of thing to do, really. And it's the man sexually selecting for youth and beauty, and the woman sexually selecting for wealth. So that's what's going on. So I can't see. You know, you won't have gone through the same things at the same time. You won't have gone through the same life events at the same time, and so you would expect these relationships to be quite unstable, perhaps the people were not particularly genetically similar and are acting in a quite a sort of fast life history strategy sort of way. So I didn't understand why anybody would want to go out with somebody where there was a massive age difference, unless it was for those kinds of reasons.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Ed, is there anything else on any of these topics that you'd like to add?
Oh, no. I've done videos on most of the topics that you raised, and people can find those on my BitChute channel, where I put all my videos and some of them on the YouTube channel.
And also, Ed, do you want to plug your books?
Oh, well, yeah, there's the number of books that I've got. There's At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future. There's Race Differences, Ethnocentrism, Churchill's Headmaster, The Sadist Nearly Saved the British Empire. There's a number of others. I've got one coming out soon on race, and then another one on feminism, and then other things I'm doing. So, yeah, I've got plenty of books going on.
And you have a book on Islam, but it's not necessarily anti-Muslim. You talk about a more of a nuanced stance, like the evolutionary benefits to
growth in Islam.
Well, yeah, I mean,
they're the people. The book is called Why Islam Makes You Stupid, but also means you'll conquer the world. Yeah, that's my newest book. Yeah, that's right. That's certainly the case. In terms of winning the battle of group selection, they are doing everything right. And so I just thought to myself, well, what exactly are they doing? Let's look at it. And what it seems to be is that our problem really is that we're too intelligent. We as a culture are too intelligent. And once our intelligence goes down, it's the people that are of low intelligence, that's what's associated in this high culture that we're in.
It's interesting within the Muslim world is Iran has historically been more advanced, and they have the kind of Indo-European component, but Iran, they have, the lowest fertility in the entire Muslim world at the same time.
Well, yeah, it's so odd. And the thing is, we don't have good IQ data on Iran, so maybe their IQ is higher than we think, and that's part of what's going on, because it seems that if you have high intelligence and you get to a certain level of societal development, then for some reason you seem to stop having children. And this has happened again and again. It happened with the Greeks. It happened with the Romans. It happened with in Baghdad in the 800s. It's again and again and again. You get to a certain level of intelligence, a certain level of luxury, and your religiousness starts to go down. And then the more intelligent their religiousness starts to go down first. They stop having children. The society goes backwards. And the brilliant thing about us, the difference with us, as a people, is that for various reasons, the Black Death is probably one, we selected for religion so strongly, we were so religious, that when we got to that same level of intelligence and same level of luxury, we were still religious and didn't start questioning the gods yet. We carried on to a later stage past the Industrial Revolution. We had to be more intelligent to start questioning religiousness, because we were so religious. And we've been so, I did a paper on this, we were so strongly selected for religiousness in medieval Europe. And so that's why we're unique, the Western culture, that we got past, we had to be more intelligent to stop believing in God.
Ed Dutton, it has been an excellent talk. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you. Goodbye.